Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Iraqi refugees flock to Lebanon but remain in a legislative limbo. The Vatican Library reopens its doors to journalists after a lengthy restoration. And 9 days that changed the world. A new documentary on Pope John Paul II's historic 1979 visit to Poland airs at the UN in New York. They've been fleeing their homeland for more than 7 years now, seeking peace and a place to start over. Millions of Iraqi Christians and Muslims have streamed across the borders into neighboring countries like Syria and Jordan, trying to put the bloodshed, kidnappings, and heartaches of the conflict in their country behind them. The UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, is estimating that 25 to 50,000 Iraqi refugees are currently present in Lebanon. But Isabel Sade, coordinator of the Caritas Migrant Center in Beirut, says those numbers are steadily climbing. She says some 20 to 25 new families are arriving in the country each month, but find themselves in legislative limbo, with no visas and no rights.
As for Caritas Migrant Center, we have around 10,000 Iraqi refugees who are being followed by the team of Caritas.
As far as the people that you are personally helping there with Caritas, where are they located? Where are they living?
They are spread all over the country because they are urban refugees. But, for example, we can see in the south of Lebanon and in the north and as well as in the Bekaa. And in Beirut, and they are in specific areas, for example, the Christian among the Christian community and the Muslim among the Muslim community.
And you are cooperating with the UNHCR, with the United Nations Refugee Services?
We are one of UNHCR partners. All these families coming recently, they are the most poor people, if we can say. They waited until now to leave because they did not have the money to pay the airplane ticket or to leave their country. And these people, they have a lot of trauma problems, they have a lot of medical problems, and they need to be assisted. And one of the major challenges is the legal status, because Lebanon did not sign the Geneva Convention, so does not recognize the status of refugees. So once they arrive to Lebanon, if they come legally through the airport, they get a visa for 1, 2 to 3 months renewable, but later on they become illegal. And this is the most big challenge for them and for us as an NGO.
So what are you doing to try to change this situation?
We have been trying to lobby with the Lebanese government. So last year in 2009, we were able to get an amnesty. And the refugees who were illegal, they had the chance to find a sponsor and to get a work permit and a residence permit for 1 year. Now, for 2010, we were not yet able to get this amnesty yet, but we are hoping that we will have it soon.
Are most of these Iraqi refugees hoping one day to return to their homes?
Unfortunately, no. The majority wish to be resettled in a third country.
So they don't want to stay in Lebanon?
No, for them, Lebanon is a transit country.
I know that the situation of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon has always been a topic of heated debate. Palestinian refugees from the 1948 war with Israel there's some 300,000 to 400,000 of them living in Lebanon now in camps. Palestinian refugees are denied the possibility to work, to have access to social services in Lebanon. We're seeing the same sort of situation there with the Iraqi refugees. Is this a combined problem?
Yes, it's more or less also affecting the Iraqi refugees. They are working, but they are working as daily labor. So people who have some diplomas cannot work as lawyers, as doctors, or even as nurse. So it's a bit challenging.
And what about schools and health services for the refugees?
Refugees, they have access to public schools like any Lebanese and private schools as well. But private schools are expensive. Now, for the medical, they have also access to public hospitals like any Lebanese. So even Lebanese, when they are using the public services, they have to pay. So refugees, they are treated the same. But as Caritas, we are assisting, for example, on the medical level. We are providing 100% coverage for all chronic medication, up to 85% coverage for non-chronic medication and inpatient medical care. We are also providing education assistance for the children. This year, as an example, as Caritas alone, we have assisted 1,375 children to be enrolled in schools, public and private schools.
That's very admirable. You must have met a lot of these people and talked to them and heard their stories. What are some of the stories that have moved you the most?
When we have children who have experienced the kidnap and they are still living the trauma, when we have women widowed who came alone with her children without knowing anything about their husband, if he is still alive or not. So these are really very hard stories to hear on a daily basis.
It must be so traumatic for these people as well. You talked there about children being kidnapped themselves or having family members kidnapped. What kind of psychological assistance are you able to offer these refugees who have gone such dramatic trauma?
We have been providing psychosocial follow-up. We have two full-time psychologists. Although the assistance provided by a psychologist is still a taboo for some families and maybe sometimes in the Arab world, so it's not easy even to outreach these refugees. But now things are improving because we have the social workers who do regular follow-up, daily follow-up, and even home visits to build the trust between the family and the social worker. So we have our psychologists who conduct individual follow-up, but also sometimes group or therapy or even family therapy for several families who have experienced the same trauma.
Now, you said a lot of these refugees would like to go to a third country and restart a life for themselves. Have you been able to facilitate that for any of these families?
In fact, it's not Caritas' role, but it's UNHCR. And for 2009, we know that there were 2,000 people from Lebanon, more or less, were resettled from Lebanon to a third country. The majority went to the U.S.
Okay, and so you've, together with UNHCR, have been working with the U.S. authorities to facilitate the visa situation for many of these refugees.
Yes.
What about some of the European countries or other countries in the region?
We have some families who went to other European countries, but the big bulk is being sent to the USA. European countries, they don't have big quotas for Iraqi refugees.
Now, Lebanon is a very open, almost Western society. You have many, many Christians in Lebanon, as well as Muslims. How have the Christian and the Muslim Iraqis who are flooding into the country, how have they been received by the local population?
In fact, they are welcomed. As I mentioned previously, they are living in areas where, for example, Christian are living where Christian Lebanese are, and Muslim the same. And we have among the Muslim community, we have many mixed marriage, Iraqi men married to Lebanese women. They have been assisted and supported by the local community.
And as we've seen in the Palestinian refugee camps, they basically are living in little neighborhoods all together. Where are you able to find housing for the Iraqi refugees?
They are living in urban areas and in poor areas, if we can say. So, and they are paying for small rooms, expensive rent. First, because they don't have the legal status, so they try as much as they can to hide. Also, in poor areas, maybe they can be supported also. As Caritas, we have field offices all over Lebanon, and even in the areas where the majority of Iraqis are settled.
What happens if an Iraqi refugee who has not obtained legal status yet in the country is caught by the security forces?
He may be arrested. That's why we have noticed that many women are working while men are at home, because they have more risk of being arrested. But once they are arrested, Caritas, they have a presence even inside detention, and we try to lobby with the government not to be deported. And we inform directly also UNHCR to check if there's a way to find quickly a resettlement country, so to avoid deportation.
How is Caritas cooperating with some of the Islamic Muslim charities?
In fact, all NGOs working with Iraqi refugees, they are coordinating with UNHCR. So everyone is attending UNHCR coordination meeting, and we are sharing lists together to avoid duplication. And because Caritas is also present in Muslim areas, we are also collaborating with Muslim NGOs working with the Iraqi refugees. And things are going very good on this way.
Isabel Sade is coordinator of the Caritas Migrant Center in Beirut. The Vatican's Apostolic Library opened its doors to journalists Monday after 3 years of exhaustive restoration to reinforce the foundations and modernize the 15th century building. A press conference offered a rare, if not almost impossible, chance to see the inside of one of the world's most prestigious institutions for historical research, usually open exclusively to scholars. The Vatican Library possesses over a million old, rare, and printed books. With some 65,000 works, its collection of illuminated manuscripts is one of the world's most extensive. The 3-year remodeling project included new elevators, which now connect restoration and photographic laboratories and archives to the manuscript storage rooms and reading rooms. Modern climate control units now keep archival storage and research rooms free from humidity and maintain constant temperatures to safeguard the centuries-old manuscripts. Library Prefect Monsignor Cesare Pazzini says the reading rooms and archives are ready and waiting to welcome back scholars when the library officially opens September 20th.
Quali sono le novità? Le metto in modo sintetico.
He explains some of the novelties they'll find when they return. The computerization of the entrance procedure, thanks to an ID card equipped with a radio frequency ID microchip that scholars will receive when they apply. In the reading rooms, scholars will have the possibility to hook up to the library's network via Wi-Fi using their own personal computers from their desk in the room. And thanks to microchip tags in the books and to a security and surveillance system installed throughout the library, personnel can follow the eventual transfer of books from one area to another, and if necessary, to prevent a volume from being taken without authorization.
La sottrazione dei volumi, anche questo, lo capite bene, è importante.
They were 9 days that were to change the world. Pope John Paul II's historic visit in June 1979 to his native Poland was a wake-up call to Poles who had for decades submitted to communist domination under the Soviets. Well, my kids are too young to know what happened as a result of the Pope's trip home, but it's important that they hear how he helped change the path of history. How the Pope helped bring down the Berlin Wall. Now, thanks to a new documentary, they'll be able to learn the story.
Perhaps at no time in the 20th century had one man so influenced the nation. It sparked a great movement of human liberation throughout Eastern Europe.
A revolution of conscience that confronted the lies of Marxism and Leninism. It led to the freedom of millions.
Former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Newt Gingrich and his wife have produced the movie 9 Days That Changed the World. And with the sponsorship of the Holy See's Permanent Observer Mission to the United Nations, we're due Tuesday to play the documentary at a special screening at the U.N. headquarters in New York. Gingrich, who was recently received into the Catholic Church, says Pope John Paul II's historic pilgrimage to Poland in 1979 created a revolution of conscience that transformed Poland and fundamentally reshaped the spiritual and political landscape of the 20th century.
From the moment he arrived in Warsaw, John Paul II began the liberation of his people through the power of faith and moral conviction.
The 9 days of John Paul II in June 1979 were 9 days on which the history of the 20th century turned in a dramatic way.
One third of the country saw him in person. Millions more witnessed his pilgrimage on television and radio.
Nie stąpi duch twój i odnowi oblicze ziemi tej.
That was an appeal. Change Poland, and the Spirit will be with you. That was a clear message that was taken by us.
Well, Irene Lagan caught up with Gingrich and his wife Calista by phone and asked them what inspired them to produce the film.
Well, we learned about the significance of this trip in 2008 when we were conducting interviews for our documentary about President Ronald Reagan. And at that time, we traveled to Gdansk, Poland, to interview President Lech Wałęsa. And then we traveled to Prague to interview President Václav Havel. And in both interviews, we asked about Pope John Paul II's role in bringing about the end of communism. And both presidents described the Holy Father's role as critical in liberating Eastern Europe. So it was from this that we went forth to make a documentary on the 9-day visit.
What are your hopes for this movie? What are your hopes that people will draw from it?
Well, I think one of the primary messages of this movie is that no state or government can get between you and God, that true freedom can only be achieved and sustained through our faith.
You were talking about, or at one point, I think it was Newt perhaps, who mentioned the parallels between communism in Poland and the growing secularism that we see not only just in Europe, but in the U.S. as well. Would that be an accurate statement, or can you elaborate
sure,
on that?
I think it's a very accurate statement. You have a very secular, hostile bureaucracy in Brussels. You have a very secular, hostile pattern in the courts, the bureaucracies, and the news media in the United States. I remind audiences that Pope John Paul II was visiting a country where the government would not allow children to pray in school and where the government was tearing down crosses. Well, those two things describe the United States today. And I think the people of faith have to understand the degree to which we are under enormous pressure from secularization and the degree to which secularism is aggressively trying to wipe out religion in any public expression. As you know, I mean, there have been extraordinary efforts in Europe to destroy the Christian tradition and the Christian identity, and yet how can you describe Western civilization if you eliminate all of the religious components?
What we see happening, too, is that this is obviously, or November 9th was the 20 years since the fall of the wall. Do you view this almost as communism taking on different forms and restricting people's freedom or liberty in the same way, but just with a different face, so to speak?
Well, I don't think it's, I would say that secularism and socialism have a unique history going all the way back to the French Revolution and the anti-clerical tradition in the French Revolution. And I would say, you know, it's very significant that Orwell wrote 1984 as a novel, not about the Soviet Union, but about Great Britain, because he was afraid, even though he was a left-wing intellectual, he was afraid that the centralized patterns and centralized planning were going to ultimately create a tyranny. Similarly, Hayek wrote the Road to Serfdom, not in opposing the Soviet Union or opposing Nazi Germany, but in opposing the rise of centralized planning in the democracies. You know, and I think you combine this socialist model of central government, Brussels or Washington, controlling everything, bureaucrats defining our lives, with secularism. And the Pope says in our movie, In 9 Days to Change the World, the Pope makes the point that combining democracy with relativism may be the most devastating threat to religious faith that we've ever faced, because relativism, this idea that there is no right or wrong, there is no God, there is no faith, in many ways it undermines our very humanness and leaves us vulnerable to being preyed upon by various fanatic political movements.
This film, will this message get out, sort of a vehicle to combat the secularist movement in our culture? Will this get out?
Well, we're taking it to various college campuses. We've been at Catholic University here in Washington. We've been at Georgetown, as well as Ave Maria School of Law.
The couple has organized a series of screenings across the U.S. and presented the film in Warsaw and Rome in the summer of 2010.
This is a way that initially we're getting the film out. We also want to get it into Catholic schools and parishes, and we really want it to penetrate, and I think over time it will.
So you think that this message, this growing secularism that people will understand and make this connection, that this trend that we see towards growing secularism, restriction of certainly religious rights and certainly more fanaticism in some sectors?
I think in the first showings that we've had, where we've had a chance to talk afterwards with people, there is a whole new generation of young people who've grown up after the Soviet Union, after the profound struggle for liberty. And we find, as we talk to them, that they are inspired by this movie, and equally important, they're educated by it. This is not stuff that their secular professors or their history teachers are going to cover. And so many of them are shocked to realize how big an impact the Pope had and how big an impact the Catholic Church had in liberating Eastern Europe and in the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And I think that the film, in that sense, has enormous potential. We are going to be producing it in Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Polish, and Chinese in the first wave. And as we raise more money, we're going to have more languages added, because we think this is a film with a universal message, and that everybody who seeks freedom through faith, and everybody who seeks to understand the fullness of the true human rights have to include religious liberty. I think that this gives us an opportunity to reach out virtually across the entire planet.
Now, let me switch gears just for a second. Calista, you have family roots in Poland, and Newt, you're just celebrating a year since you've been received into the Catholic Church. Calista, in your case, did filming this movie, going to Poland, what did this process of filming the movie do for your faith? And Newt, same question, your journey towards Catholicism, what led you there and how did this film contribute, the making of this film?
Well, I grew up as a Polish Catholic in Wisconsin, and we grew up with all the traditions of the church and the Polish culture. And so for me, Pope John Paul II has always been my hero. And so it's been a great privilege and honor to be able to work on this film. So it does have a lot of personal meaning for me.
I think for me there are two patterns. One is that Calista sings in the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington. And I've gone to Mass now for over a decade. And just the experience, Sunday after Sunday, listening to the homilies, experiencing the music and the beauty of the church, I gradually found myself, I think, becoming Catholic, and figured that out in retrospect. I don't think it was a decision. It was the awareness of a fact. In addition, starting with George Weigel's book, The Cube and the Cathedral, which is a brilliant, brief analysis of the threat of secularism in Europe and in America, and then going through Weigel's biography of the Pope and Witness to Hope, and then for me, his very significant The Final Revolution, which talks about the role of the church in Eastern Europe. Those things all helped, along with long conversations with Monsignor Rossi, the rector of the Basilica, really began to get me thinking deeply about the lessons that the Pope inherently embodied and that the trip embodied. And I think all those things had an impact on me. I don't know that they were conscious. I think the final moment for me was having the opportunity to be at the Basilica when Pope Benedict XVI came and had Vespers with the American bishops, and Calista and the choir were invited to sing for the Vespers. And as a spouse, I was invited to come. And seeing the Pope, seeing the joy in his eyes, the degree to which I resonated to Christ, our hope, which was his motto for the trip, That was the day I actually turned to Monsignor Rossi and said, I do want to be received into the church. And I think it was a culmination of a process.
John Paul II had an enormous visible impact, very favorable impact. What do you see happening now, certainly in the church and in the world? Benedict is not getting anywhere near the same reception, and yet he too reaches out across those divides. How do you, both of you, see that, or what perspective can you offer on that?
Well, I think you have to see the two popes as actually being partners. For virtually all of Pope John Paul II's leadership of the church, Cardinal Ratzinger was his chief intellectual partner, his chief developer of doctrine. And I think in the process, the two of them have both consciously tried to move the church back to a fundamental belief and faith in God, and a fundamental belief in the mission of the church to offer salvation to every person on the planet, and to be genuinely Catholic in the original meaning of the word, to reach out to everyone everywhere. And you know, I think the secularists take advantage of every opportunity they have to attack. But in the end, there are well over a billion people who are Catholic, and you have a 2,000-year tradition. And my hunch is that just as the church recovered under the original Pope Benedict, remember, the church was on the ropes, just as it recovered when the monks in Ireland were the last stand of preserving religious literature, I have a hunch that in the end, the secularists will fail. Ronald Reagan is in our film with a wonderful quote in the speech at the Berlin Wall, where he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," which is the famous line. There's a section late in the speech where he talks about freedom and he talks about faith. And he says, you know, communism, this wall will not be able to stand up against faith. This wall will not be able to stand up against freedom. I think I would say to the secularist in Brussels and the secularist in Washington, in the end, you cannot create a world without God. You cannot create a government against God. And you cannot create a government which oppresses people and blocks them from God. And therefore, you will lose. And there will be a rebirth of religious liberty across the world.
We really want people to realize that this 9-day visit is a story of human liberation, and it reveals the extraordinary power of Pope John Paul II's worldwide message of freedom through faith. And that's what we want people to take away from this movie.
Do you believe that that message will be received more easily in parts of Europe that have experienced the oppression of communism versus countries that have enjoyed such liberty and aren't necessarily aware of the restrictions on freedom, haven't experienced the same oppression?
I'm not sure that's the case for this reason. I think there are many people whose lives are banal, meaningless, and desperate in the most prosperous of countries and the greatest of freedom. And I think those people may, in fact, find the Pope's message as personally compelling as anything you're going to find in a country that's oppressed. I think that in the end, the message of the cross and the message of Christ appeals to the heart. And there are an enormous number of people in wealthy countries who are drug addicted, alcoholic, or desperate, who need the opportunity to approach God and to recognize that only by subordinating yourself to a larger being can you possibly find true peace and a true opportunity to live a life to its fullest.
Former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Newt Gingrich and his wife Calista Gingrich speaking there about their new movie, 9 Days That Changed the World.
The power of the papacy was never more visible. And the Soviets learned this to their dismay, that he could turn their empire inside out.
Throughout the 2,000-year history of the papacy, only two popes served longer than John Paul II.
From his humble roots in Krakow, he became the leader of a billion Catholics, the most recognized and possibly the most influential man of our lifetime.
I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.